coast of Europe were able to travel around the world with a vision of themselves and capital accumulation. And they managed to colonize much of the world, and they managed to engage in the slave trade and bring five times as many slaves to the New World. And they also managed at the same time to precipitate the genocide of millions and millions of native people. And that interlocking reality was one that actually carried the forces of empire forward in the 17th century, which we are now dealing with. So as we talk about capitalism and we talk about the transformation of capitalism, we need to understand that the earliest celebration of capitalism was in the Dutch Empire across the street from the Dutch West Indies Company. And the New York Stock Exchange was also born at a time when the Africans were buried without marking. So I think we have this opportunity at this moment, and I'm speaking of the opportunity, to extend the vision that you are putting forward in a way that would actually create the possibility that the next time that you gather to celebrate this vision, that you would be able to continue to advocate the vision with an audience that actually looked like the people in this country. Thank you.
Thank you, Carl. I would, building on your remarks, one of the things I realized that...
Is your microphone on?
Yeah, in my final presentation, I had this list of institutional things that we needed to do. I think I'm going to add to that that one of our challenges in the United States is, well, we're in a position where we really have to create a truly multiracial, multireligious, et cetera, global society. Now, there are only a few countries on Earth where we have truly multiracial, multireligious populations. And that creates a special challenge in the United States. How do we move forward to create a vision of an ideal multiracial, multireligious society? What will it look like? And I thank both of you for helping me introduce that into my own thinking. Sorry to keep you waiting.
That's okay. I have another thing you can add to your list. I really appreciate the comments that were just said, and I'd like to take it back a little step further, because I was 99.9% with you the whole time, but the one piece that didn't land for me was when you were talking about the original Enlightenment and how it came out of the dark arts. And for me, as a witch, I immediately went to...
That was... I didn't talk about the dark arts.
I'm familiar. Black Madonna, woo! You know, I just wanted to, you know, make the comment and see if you want to speak to it that, you know, the Hammer of Witches was written in the mid-1400s, and then fast forward, the Enlightenment came, and, you know, women were being burned in the streets daily while we, and what we hear about is all of these men coming up with amazing, beautiful ideas, which are very important and beautiful, but we don't get told about that history. And the history, I believe, is what is at the root of all of the oppression, the dehumanization, and the objectification of people all around the world, people of color, queer people, disabled people, you name it. And so I'm just, you know, I'd love for you to speak to, in your vision of the new Enlightenment and the creativity that's possible there, what do you see as the role for women and people of color and queer people and all of it, from a systemic level, how do you see that changing? And then also maybe a little bit about kind of a energetic archetypal sacred masculine feminine rebalancing.
I just say the organization I've been most involved in for the last 20 years is Yes Magazine, in which the women pretty much run the show. So Anyhow, I mean, clearly the... I think I've got it on, yeah. Maybe it needs, the volume needs to go up, or I can speak louder. I mean, clearly to me, the idea of an ecological civilization, I mean, as life organizes, diversity is foundational. And in terms of this whole idea of the unfolding of creation toward ever greater complexity, beauty, et cetera, the complexity is diversity. It's the diversity of species. It's within the human context. It's the diversity of races and ideas and genders and the whole thing. Now, I would say that in our current dialogue on these issues, that I am concerned that we get so involved in identity politics that we lose sight of the imperial frame, which puts a few people at the top and most people at the bottom. Now, the way we have characteristically dealt with that over the past 5,000 years is a division by gender and skin color. It makes it very easy to decide who's on the bottom and who's on the top, and we absolutely have to move beyond that. But to me, it's not a matter of just removing a glass ceiling for women or people of color. It is eliminating the structures of domination. So anyhow, that's... I think we're on the same
page. Yeah, I'd like to say a word about the last point that you raised about the sacred masculine. Because I wrote a book on this a few years ago, The Hidden Spirituality of Men, 10 Metaphors to Awaken the Sacred Masculine. And the first response I got from the book was from a woman. And she emailed me and she said, I have over 200 books on the goddess in my home library, not a single book on the sacred masculine. And she said, I don't regret it at all, the last 40 years of my life of trying to recover the goddess and the divine feminine. But she said, I do have two teenage sons. And what you say is true, that, and I didn't realize till I read your book how much men have suffered under patriarchy. So what you say is true, she said, the next step of feminism has to be to clean up, assist our brothers to clean up the masculine. And I think this fits with what David just said, that the structure is toxic patriarchy. And men as well as women and people of color and gays and lesbians and others suffer under this. So I think it's important to not just throw out the masculine or to turn the masculine into soft men, but rather to find what are the serious archetypes in our human heritage for healthy masculinity. So I named 10 of them, among them Father Sky, the Green Man, the Blue Man, the Hunter-Gatherer, the Spiritual Warrior, Father, the Grandfather, the Elder, and so forth. And I think these are bigger than any religion or any culture. And I think if we could tune into these, we would be doing everybody a service, women, men alike. And a response I had from the book came from a Native American who came up to me and he said, I've been working in prisons for 12 years. Men's prison. And he said, men in prison are very reluctant to look inside. They want to project on others all the time. For 12 years, I've been trying to find a book to get them to look inside. He said, yours is the first book I've gotten that they want to read and look inside and find the nobility inside. Now that phrase to me is stunning. Men have trouble finding, they don't want to look inside because they can't find the nobility inside. Again, to me, this goes back to the original sin idea, to the fatalistic self-hatred that Adrian Rich talks about. And so both men and women, I think, have to be active in detoxing masculinity in our culture. It's clear we have a president who is an archetype of the capitalist miser and the dominator. And that is a version of masculinity that still reigns in our culture. So women and men all have an investment in this. And so I thank you for your question. I think it's a very important question.
Well done. Thank you. I really appreciate
this conversation. As a white male scientist, I'm a physicist, and Einstein, I think, was quoted as saying, or as being naive, because he was also someone interested in politics, and people would say, well, physics is easy compared to politics. And I think that's true for these reasons that you're bringing up. The thing that stuck with me, and that I think we talked about in our group a bit, you talked about fatalistic self-hatred as underlying, I think, the religious dominant era, fatalistic self-hatred that men or and all individuals carry inside them to some extent. And what that bring up for us and for me is around fundamentalist thinking, or as members of our group called fixed thinking, and how easily any kind of fight against one fundamentalist thinking becomes another fundamentalist thinking, and how we might associate fundamentalism with specific sects or market fundamentalism or religious fundamentalism, but really it comes down to how we behave every day and whether we have a fixed and open mind. And I certainly see this as someone studying physics. I study synchronicity, which is not something that's in the mainstream physics, and so I see the closed-mindedness. And so I'd like to hear more also from you, if you have anything to say about how to address, how to flip all the pieces of the puzzle over to show the other side, rather than continuing to fight against individual fundamentalist thinking to try and flip every piece one at a time.
Well, for me, a great insight about fundamentalism came when I read the book by one of the founders of chaos theory called Chaos, Gaia, and Eros. In it, he says that in the ancient days before patriarchy, chaos was a goddess in the culture who was worshipped and welcomed into the society. And then when patriarchy took over, the story shifted, and chaos became the enemy that you had to kill. So then we had the story of Marduk killing Tiamat, for example. And it's his feeling that his conviction that first religion took that animus to control chaos, and we call chaos heresy. And then in the 17th century, science took it up and said, "No, we're the ones with the truth, so we'll take over from religion." And that science played this role up until the 1960s when chaos theory was brought forward. And then, of course, and now we're dealing with that. So what I learned from that, and he and I did some dialogues together on chaos. He would talk about science and I would talk about the dark night of the soul, because that's an experience of chaos too that people have and are going through. But what really hit home, once when we did that dialogue at a UU church in San Francisco, a woman came up to me, she said, "I'm a midwife." And she said, "Nothing is more chaotic than birth." She said, "There's blood all over the walls. But look what comes out of it, new being." And then it just hit me like thunder that, of course, this is why a goddess civilization looked on chaos as a blessing and incorporated it as a goddess, didn't see it as a problem. And so I think that fundamentalism is always, whether it's religious or political, which is fascism, where it's always a reach into the arena of law and order, control. We have been designated by God to put control and law and order first. Whereas a chaos is precisely about the actions of spontaneity and creativity. Now, humans cannot survive with too much law and order or too much chaos. We have to find that dance between the two. And I think that's where we often fall in trouble. In a time like ours, where there's a lot of apocalyptic fear in the air, of course, fundamentalism is strong in lots of places of the world. And that's because people are afraid and they want to cling to something very clear and distinct. But at the same time, we have to be agents. I think we all have to learn to dance nimbly in this time of chaos. And we have to learn to live with chaos and to embrace her once again. That chaos is intrinsic to the very creativity that is going to save our species. So that's how I see fundamentalism, the context of chaos and law and order. And I think it's a lurching away. from the reality of chaos. And I think it's wonderful that science is now on board that chaos is intrinsic to all of our natural systems. And without it, things would not grow and expand. Things would be dead in the water and very boring at the same time.
I just say quickly, in terms of what you do with science, I think back to the experience I mentioned with Willis Harmon at Stanford, with a group of scientists that recognized the limitations of science's boundaries. And so they didn't spend time criticizing other scientists. They formed an alliance of those who were exploring the new ideas and built on that. And that, to me, is a key. I never spend my time trying to convince the people who have an absolute opposite point of view. I try to give courage to those who recognize at least what I consider to be truth to speak it and join together. So.
I think that's a very good point. Rabbi Heschel said that too. He never spent his time responding to his denouncers, of which he had so many.
Yeah.
He said, life is too short. Let's keep marching forward.
So first off, thank you for what you're providing. I'm also in David's group. There are three points that I just want to mention quickly. One about chaos is that it allows for emergence. It just simply means it's not predictable in a standard way, and that can be the way a faucet drips or the weather. But in that emergence is where things are born, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes wildly, yeah, like at birth. But, you know, we're also always giving birth. The other piece that Sky referred to is a woman named Carol Dweck wrote a book called Mindset. And she talks about open mindsets and fixed mindsets. Open mindsets are open to what emerges and feedback. And I coach capitalists, and I actually transform them. I do. Completely.
Yes, what?
I transform capitalists. Oh,
good.
I go into the belly of the beast called investment banks, private equity, and the largest law firm in the world, and I transform their lives through the power of my word. That's what I do for a living, okay? Mm. So I'm very interested in what's going on here, and I do it effectively. And doing it effectively means I do it in a way in which their cash register can continue to ring, which allows me to stay inside. And as I stay inside, I alter them. So I just want to say that. And one of the things why I'm saying that is because feedback is the breakfast of champions regarding anything, yes? And if you're open to feedback, you grow faster in whatever direction you're growing. So there's something about what Sky was saying about fundamentalism. If we can stay open ourselves, we have some access there. So that was one point that came up in the group. The second is it's all a conversation. The unit of action is a conversation. So there are huge ideas, but when it's going to get played out, when we're back where we are, is one conversation at a time, including with ourselves. So I don't have a chance of dealing with racism in the world, not a prayer, until I deal with my racism. I don't have a shot at dealing with anything called sexism until I deal with my own. It just is very clear to me that the source of it is me creatively and effectively confronting my own internal conversations. So I just want to say that. And the third thing was, there were three of us at the table, maybe more, who were over 70. One person had confronted cancer, another person was taking on an oil company. And then, in any case, there's this thing about what the boomers can do now, because they're the best endowed generation, at least in this white Western culture, in terms of education, opportunity, networks. So, and they're growing, they're starting up more companies than any other age group, including millennials, is boomers. So I'm betting on and pulling for that boomers wake up as an elder generation that can equip the next generation. And the more that conversation gets around, the more they'll step up. It's there, it just needs good nudging. So I just wanted to share that, okay?
Thank you. Our time is up now.
Yeah.
So I think we have to, I'm sorry, I think we have to,
goes down.
Well, I'm happy to stay longer if others want to.
Yeah, it would be good if we give these last.
Okay.
Is everybody open? We can give the last
three. Try to keep it kind of succinct.
And we'll try to keep our responses really short.
Okay, so, you know, I'm a member of
the younger generation here. There's a few of us here, but not really that many. And, you know, all this discussion of the ecological crisis, and it's a really tough thing to think about, and it's a tough thing to confront. And, you know, I feel like there are these certain kind of contradictions in the way we talk about it, where, so you were talking about, like, trying to get away from the sort of self-loathing and self-hatred that drives consumer capitalism. But then on the other hand, I can't really come up with a deeper expression of self-hatred than the idea that we're cancerous parasites to planet Earth. I can't really think of anything that's a deeper form of self-loathing than that. And it's not like you're wrong. It's not like there isn't something terribly wrong with our relationship. But I've had that pounded into me my whole life. That's the way I grew up. That's the way all of my friends grew up. And you wonder why we have this huge problem with anxiety and depression and drug use. You wonder why none of us want to have kids. There's the cultural suicide going on, more so than capitalism, from where I'm standing. I don't know what to do about it. But the amount of people I know that are my age that feel absolutely dreadfully hopeless when they look at it, that's why they don't want to address it. It's not because they haven't heard it. It's because it's the most daunting, hopeless thing to think about. And we've all heard it. And, you know, I don't know what to do about it, but, like, I'm just kind of thinking here. I mean, this foundation, IONS, was founded by Edgar Mitchell. And it happened because of the spiritual experience he had looking back on Earth from space. And, you know, there's a hopeful thought to me. Humanity going to space, going into the cosmos, cosmic humanity, cosmic civilization. That's something that I can think of as being hopeful to move forward. I don't know, those are just some thoughts I have, I wanted to share. It's a tough thing to confront.
Thank you. I'd like to respond to that. First of all, thank you for your courage in sharing that. There's an amazing book by a fellow named Scott Sanders, and it's called Hunting for Hope, A Father's Journey. And it sounds like your story, because Sanders is a writer, and for years he was writing about the Earth crisis and so forth, so forth, and he took a 17-year-old son out for a camping trip. And he felt this would be the high point of their bonding, this marvelous camping trip. But what happened was just the opposite. His son spoke like this young man spoke, only more passionately, I guess. And he said, "Dad, I don't want to talk to you ever again. All you do is talk about the crisis of the Earth. It's all you write about. It's all you think about. Have you no hope at all?" And this absolutely crushed his father. And his father took a two-year sabbatical to hunt for hope. Just kind of what I think we were hearing from this young man. And he wrote a beautiful book called Hunting for Hope, A Father's Journey. And I'd just like to share with you a few lines from that. I have it in my book on the sacred masculine. He says, "I still hanker for the original world, the one that makes us rather than the one we make. I hunger for contact with the shaping power that curves the comet's path and fills the owl's throat with song and fashions every flake of snow and carpets the hills with green. It is a prodigal, awful, magnificent power, forever casting new forms into existence, then tearing them apart and starting over." And he talks about a mystical experience he's had at night. He said, "I climbed out of the car with a greeting on my lips. but the sky hushed me. From the black bowl of space, countless fiery lights shone down, each one a sun, or a swirl of suns, the whole brilliant host of them enough to strike me dumb. He says, our faith must be in our capacity for decent and loving work, in the healing energy of wildness, in the holiness of creation. That the universe exists at all, that it obeys laws, that those laws have brought forth galaxies and stars and planets, and on one planet at least, life, and out of life consciousness, and out of consciousness these words, this breath. This is a chain of wonders. I dangle from that chain and hold on tight. I think this is a beautiful naming of the recovery of Father Sky. And I think you were talking about that in a certain way when you talk about cosmology. That cosmology does bring hope back. But I think it's illusory to think that we can travel to Mars or to Venus without dealing first with our stuff. That we'll just bring our stuff to Mars and our stuff to Venus, and what could be worse than that? And furthermore, it's so elitist to think, what, a group of 17 people in a capsule are going to escape the Earth? I mean, it's just crazy, and it's giving up on billions of others. So I think it's obscene. But I do sense in the plea of this young man that the very plea that that Sanders' 17-year-old son had, that the new generation cannot just hear the bad news. They've got to hear what the good news is too. And I just love that image of we're chained to the wonders, not only of the sky, but of the history that brought all of us here. It's 13.8 billion years, and it's 2 trillion galaxies big. And that is a lot of the source of where we derive our hope, it seems to me.
Yeah, I would note that none of us can presume to have answers to all the problems, and I admit to having no solution to this young man's problem. I do note that in terms of going to Mars, there's no drinkable water or breathable air. So
except for that.
It's
real promises.
Really interesting. I mean, actually, that's part of really appreciating living Earth. This is the only planet we know that can support us. Anything else, you got to take your air and water with you.
I hope to give a little hope now, in this contrast. I very definitely am a 60s child. I was a flower child, and I was also an SDS. I went to Cuba and the Renzo Ramos Brigade, you know, where Castro showed that he was friends with the American people, the government was the problem. And I'll tell you this, there has been a definite change.
There's what?
There's been a definite change in the kind of political action that people take now and the kind of awareness they have about it. I would say, you know, you talk about there's no original sin. Well, I think the sin in the 60s was our pride. We were so sure we were right, everybody else was wrong. You know, it led to a lot of violence, it led to a lot of self-righteousness, you know? And I see differences now in the political movement. I think a good example of it is seen in the movie Thrive. I don't know how many of you know that movie. It was by Lincoln Gamble, who's Procter & Gamble. He's a rebel. And he says exactly what you're saying. He talks about the few families that run the earth and how unfair it is. And he talks about these standard things about, you know, corporations and... But then he says, we can't fight them, because then we'll be just like them. We'll be doing more of the same. And he says, what we've got to do is not fight City Hall, but ignore City Hall. And I think that this is exactly what is really happening, is the potential for happening, is that we really are seeing that, as Lincoln Gamble puts it in the end of the movie, he says, therefore, taking a spiritual path, having spiritual practice, and integrating it with our politics is absolutely essential. That could not have been said in the 60s.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Thank you, yeah. It's like we're adding to our line.
It may not be getting better. Hi, my name is Paul. David, Matt's pleasure. Great conversation. Really appreciate it. And David, we started the conversation in the bathroom where many conversations start. I apologize. I'm from Florida, so that means you never, it's unpredictable. We don't know how to vote. But you know, I brought up the question of business models and solutions, and I appreciate, Matt, you bringing up, you know, the question of sort of what our plea is. And I've spent 20 years dealing with clean energy and climatology, and the good news is energy is going to be solved. That problem is over. I think the question is sort of other decisions we make. But my question is more about sort of business models and choices that we make, and how do we create a next system, not capitalist, not socialist, that is inevitably successful? And has anybody started down that path? Because I hear a lot of discussion of the problems, but I'm more interested in the solutions.
Yeah. Well, if you're listening, I tried to outline in my in my last presentation some of the economic shifts.
But specifically, what can we do tomorrow? What can this group do tomorrow that's going to make a difference?
Well, one of the things that I've spent a good deal of my energy on was what we call the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. It grew out of a recognition that we had, well, back in the when we formed it in the early 1980s, we had a number of really iconic responsible businesses, you know, like Ben and Jerry's and terrible on the names, but
Anita Roddick, body shop.
Yeah, Anita Roddick. These were business people who actually embraced the lesson that my dad taught me as a businessman. He says, if you're not in business to serve the community, you have no business being in business. So this is recognizing that profit is a necessity for a successful business, but it is not the ultimate purpose of the business. Now, one of the things that's very key here is you hear lots of promises, people saying, well, you know, you can make more money if you are responsible. This has been one of the fundamental fallacies of responsible investment for some time, and I've given talks to responsible business in the Rockies about this. It is an absolute contradiction to run an economic system to maximize profit and expect that you can get to sustainability, a sustainable relationship, and an equitable society. And we have been engaged in an experiment for a number of decades based on the premise that if we just pursue profits, that works out best for everybody. Well, it really didn't work. So it's, you know, in some ways, one reason I'm hesitant to do blanket condemnation of capitalism is because it depends on how you define it. Ownership in itself is not necessarily a bad thing, although we've got to reframe it in terms of what it, you know, how we exercise it. But to have an ownership stake in the means of producing your own living, like, you know, you have a small farm and you grow your food on your land, there's nothing inherently evil about that. Having a global agribusiness corporation that owns half of the cultivatable land in the world, or whatever that may be, that is evil, particularly if you're managing it to maximize profit.
Yeah. You spent time at one of arguably the best business schools in 2 trillion galaxies. I spend every day listening to CEOs. I work for the innovation group at the world's largest power company, telling me how they're going to save the world. How come there are no CEOs telling me how they're really going to save the world? How come there are no business models that I've heard that actually seem truly sustainable?
Well, because the way the system is geared, I mean, this is the problem. You may be an individual business owner who is, in fact, truly committed to running your business in a way that serves society. Now, one of the things that we learned back when we formed the Business Alliance for Local Living Economy is that these iconic businesses like Ben & Jerry's, they ended up going public, selling public shares. And once you've gone public, that means you can be bought up by all of the Wall Street banksters and restructured, and your whole purpose of your business is lost. And that was a fundamental principle of the Business Alliance, or BALA as we called it, that it had to be comprised of businesses that had a social mission or community service mission and were owned by people who controlled their shares. And that's absolutely foundational.
I'll add one thought, one word to that,
yeah.
And it's blockchain. And nobody's mentioned it tonight, but I think that's one of the fundamental technologies. If nobody's looked at it, I would encourage you to, because I think it's the number one technology today that is decentralized and enabling.
It's potentially one of the biggest frauds
ownership.
That we have ever been perpetrated on. It is the ultimate snake oil? Huh?
Snake oil?
No, it's the creation of a counterfeit currency.
I'm not encouraging
now,
anybody to go buy Bitcoin or any cryptocurrency. But the technology fundamentally enables people to share things and have trust. And I think that your interest in property and sharing property rights, that is a technology that truly enables that. It's decentralizing.
Sharing things, absolutely, but that has nothing to do with creating these special currencies. Now,
absolutely,
there's huge issues around money and how it's issued and so forth. It should be issued publicly. I mean, for it to be controlled, its issuance to be basically controlled by private banksters is a monstrosity. And of course, the whole banking system currently, its major goal is to make huge amounts of money while producing absolutely nothing of any value. But we actually, in the United States, once had a system of banking in which most of our banks that could issue credit were community banks. They were cooperatively owned, and they produced, in a sense, they had a capacity to produce currency in relation to community needs and opportunities. And of course, that's been another major transformation. But these artificial currencies, which are created by people we knew not who, it's an ultimate counterfeit currency. I was quite amazed by conversations on, the dangers of counterfeit currencies. Anyhow, that's another big long discussion.
Thank you.
Most people know that computers have been doubling exponential growth many decades. Most people don't know that solar energy has been doubling every 2 years for the past 32 years, does not have but 11 more years to go at the current pace before it alone can provide over 100% of current energy needs. From a Washington Post article saying, clean energy will be unlimited and free in 17 years.
Great.
Wow.
I do want to mention, we should have mentioned it earlier, that Matt and I will be doing a book signing at wherever the bookstore is tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And so
yeah.
You're all invited
down
to
a corridor here
come
on
to
the first
that.
Floor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wait a minute. Were you in line? I mean, we can't add to the line. We'll go on all night.
I've been kneeling.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, my brief comment is about how to fall back in love.
Mm-hmm.
Like that was the original crisis of the sacred. And so I'm a holistic nutrition coach and particularly working on what are the technologies of reacquaintment and bringing people back together. That was what our group talked about, was like, if people are lost and disconnected, then I work with the work that reconnects, a part of Joanna Macy's spiral. So because the etymology of education being educare, I looked up the etymology of apathy as well, and that comes from the Greek apatheia, which means without feeling, mm-hmm. and it adds the Greek pathos, suffering. So we don't want to feel our suffering. So part of the spiritual healing technologies, our group mentioned, was about grief ceremony, so we can actually feel the darkness that is going on and then actually reacquaint to a more beautiful world. So I'm just more interested in the future and talking less about like the banks and the president and more about like what are the real healing technologies that we need to start propagating, because I'm dealing with the toxic radiated planet that your all's generation left me, and I'm motivated and I'll do my best. Thank you.
Thank you.
I couldn't agree more that grief rituals are really important, and I've been working that for a long time. And it really matters to people, all kinds of people. We're all carrying a lot of grief, and there are so few rituals really available to reach that. And so I'm really in favor of that. And great things happen, because if you don't do the grief, there's a rock in your heart that prevents the creativity from flowing. So it has very practical results. If you can do the grief work, then the creativity flows much more profusely and freely. And so we really need grief rituals for sure.
I'm here today because I met Ed Mitchell, and I had the privilege of being in his home in Florida and assisting Ed in doing his first deposition on human consciousness. Ed made a deep impression on me. I'm also here, though, because I've been to previous conferences, and I'm impressed by the people here. I'm impressed by you as speakers. I wish I'd heard it all. I just arrived during your speech, during your presentation. And the reason for that and why I appreciate all of you here is because I see such strength and power. Everybody here has been in the old paradigm. They've been creating the new paradigm. And I also brought with me a representative of the younger generation coming up. My daughter's over there, and she'll be embarrassed that I ever mentioned anything. But we see what's now called stage left. Old paradigm, new paradigm, now stage left. We have this restlessness with younger generations looking for definitions, looking for terms, looking for leadership, knowing they don't have the same knowledge that you as speakers have and you here in the audience have. Yet, they've got that energy, they've got this old soul consciousness coming through. And so what I feel my role is to give some assistance to meeting some of you here to know what your expertise is, our brilliance that I don't have. And I'm trying to work with, as an original target market, gifted students and their administration, so that we give opportunities for real-time education that does not exist in the educational system, which is to allow younger students who are these bright minds who, excuse me, they don't care about all the isms. They want to be and they want to make their mark. They want to work in cooperation, and they lack the skill set yet to do that. So that's another piece of this. As an attorney, I'm collaboration trained, I'm mediation trained. I want to get a higher level of collaboration skills available to them. People here know how to do it based on experience and the love and capability that they have, but we're able to do it better. And what triggered my standing up here and is the thought that you had here about confusion, chaos. We have all this chaos, and yet from that chaos, we have opportunity for adventure. And I feel that you can give us more leadership, and I welcome talking more with you later, and people here, because from that chaos comes great opportunity and adventures that people here have capabilities of riding through and doing it hand in hand with younger people who know that they don't have the skill set and experience that people here have, but they will do it in combination, and I believe that strongly. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
And thank you, David. Carry on. I hope your conference goes wonderfully.
I'm lighting the fire, and I will contact you, David.
Okay.